Have you ever wondered what happens when the person you thought was your forever suddenly isn't? Dolly Alderton's Good Material takes us on this heart-wrenching journey through the eyes of Andy, a struggling comedian whose life unravels after his girlfriend Jen unexpectedly ends their relationship. The book has captivated readers worldwide with its raw portrayal of modern heartbreak, earning praise from celebrities like Taylor Swift, who called it the most honest breakup story I've ever read. Released in 2023, this novel arrived at a perfect cultural moment when society was reconsidering traditional relationship structures, making it an instant Sunday Times bestseller. Through diary entries, lists, and dual perspectives, Alderton crafts a story that feels less like fiction and more like eavesdropping on someone's most vulnerable moments. When Andy's girlfriend Jen breaks up with him after 4 years together, his world collapses spectacularly. We meet him at his lowest point, creating a bitter list titled "Reasons Why It's Good I'm Not with Jen," a desperate attempt to convince himself he's better off without her. His complaints range from petty grievances, can't dance, has no rhythm at all, to deeper relationship issues, would never talk seriously about having children, despite knowing how much I want to be a dad. But the final raw admission, "ruined my life," undercuts all his attempts at detachment, revealing the depth of his devastation. Forced to move back to his mother's house, Andy wallows in grief while his mother comforts him with Disaronno Spike Tea and Frank Sinatra's In the Wee Small Hours, the same album she played after his father left. In a particularly poignant moment, Andy takes a photo of their clothes hanging together on the washing line, "in case I forget what it feels like to be loved," before crying himself to sleep in his childhood bed. What makes this portrayal of heartbreak so compelling is its unflinching honesty. Andy isn't a stoic hero. He's messy, self-pitying, and sometimes pathetic. When he encounters the scent of Jen's perfume, Armani She, on a stranger, it triggers such intense longing that he impulsively buys all 4 bottles from the local Boots pharmacy and dumps them into a canal. A meaningless gesture that costs him $159.14 and brings no catharsis. Haven't we all had moments of irrational behavior in the throes of heartbreak, searching for symbolic acts that might somehow ease the pain? Through richly detailed flashbacks, we discover how Andy and Jen's relationship sparked to life at their mutual friend Sarah's 31st birthday party, a casual gathering at a local pub that would become the setting for their defining moment. Their first conversation crackles with chemistry as they playfully challenge each other's opinions on everything from favorite films to life philosophies, flirting to a premiership standard, while exaggerating their differences and delighting in their surprising similarities. Andy's quick wit matches perfectly with Jen's sharp comebacks, creating a verbal dance that leaves their friends watching in amused silence. When the pub closes at midnight, neither ready to end the evening, they continue their night at the Underground, a tacky club with plastic cups, peeling pleather booths, and a DJ who seems stuck in the early 2000s. They dance badly to dated pop songs, share childhood stories, and find themselves drawn closer despite the less-than-romantic setting. The timing seems almost cruel. Andy is leaving for Edinburgh's Fringe Festival the next day with his comedy show No Heavy Petting, but they maintain passionate connection through daily texts and nightly calls that stretch into the early hours. What's striking about their origin story is how ordinary yet magical it feels. There's nothing particularly cinematic about their meeting, no dramatic rain-soaked declarations or elaborate meet-cutes, just 2 people connecting authentically in the messy, imperfect way that real relationships begin. Their attraction defies conventional wisdom, and their friends raised eyebrows. Jen later admits she was drawn to Andy despite his obvious red flags. Drinking and smoking too much, living paycheck to paycheck from comedy gigs, and showing none of the traditional markers of husband material. Everything in her body told her to love him completely, and she followed that instinct against her usual careful nature. This tension between emotional truth and practical compatibility becomes central to their relationship's eventual demise. As they move from the honeymoon phase into real life, the charm of their differences begins to wear thin. Jen later reflects, eventually our initial attractions became irritations. His nonconformity became lack of structure. My independence became remoteness. The very qualities that drew them together, his free-spirited nature and her self-sufficiency, begin to create friction when faced with mundane realities like paying bills and planning for the future. Their story illustrates how the very spark that ignites a relationship can sometimes become the flame that burns it down. As the qualities we find most attractive in someone during those first electric moments can transform into sources of conflict when life's practical demands come knocking. As Andy navigates the wreckage of his relationship, he embarks on what he calls the Jen Inquiry, a desperate investigation into why she left him and what went wrong. This quest for answers drives him to increasingly absurd lengths, revealing the depths of his emotional turmoil and inability to process the breakup in healthy ways. He obsessively studies her Instagram stories for clues, analyzing every location tag and emoji with the intensity of a conspiracy theorist. He creates elaborate theories about her new boyfriend, Seb, convincing himself that their relationship must have started before his own ended, despite having no evidence to support this. His desperation reaches new heights when he visits a therapist under the fake name Clifford Beverly to discuss a fictional relationship that's actually his own. This elaborate deception allows him to explore his pain while maintaining what he believes is emotional distance, though this distance proves illusory. He constructs an entire alternate reality where he's a successful corporate lawyer named Cliff, perhaps revealing his own wishes for a more stable, prestigious career. In one particularly revealing therapy session, Andy, as Cliff, complains about his imaginary burlesque dancer girlfriend, Alice, representing himself in his relationship with Jen. He criticizes her need to grow up and get a real job, unconsciously projecting his own insecurities about his struggling comedy career and financial instability. The therapist's sharp insights cut through his elaborate facade, particularly when questioning if Andy experienced similar judgment from his father, a perceptive observation that makes him physically recoil and quickly change the subject. This search for meaning extends beyond understanding Jen's decision, becoming a broader existential crisis about identity and self-worth. Andy is equally desperate to understand himself and his place in the world now that his identity as Jen's partner has been stripped away. He realizes how much of himself he had invested in being Andy and Jen rather than just Andy. When his friend Jane asks if he's told his best friend Avi about the breakup, Andy refuses, claiming he's not ready. In reality, he's holding on to this information like a precious secret, wanting to maintain some control over the situation in a life that suddenly feels chaotic and directionless. There's a profound vulnerability in acknowledging that sometimes we cling to information as the last vestige of power when everything else has been taken from us. Andy's resistance to sharing news of the breakup with Avi, his closest friend since childhood, speaks to the shame and loss of identity that often accompanies the end of a significant relationship. By keeping this secret, he can momentarily pretend that his world hasn't completely fallen apart, even as his increasingly erratic behavior suggests otherwise. Andy's attempts to rebuild his life take tragicomic turns as he cycles through a series of increasingly unsuitable living situations, each more absurd than the last. His journey begins with a narrowboat rental on London's Regent's Canal that seems charmingly bohemian, a floating sanctuary where he imagines writing his novel and finding peace. Reality quickly intrudes when he discovers the boat lacks basic amenities. A proper toilet, instead featuring a chemical cassette that needs weekly emptying, a shower that produces only ice-cold water, and a roof that leaks precisely above his pillow during London's frequent rains. The Canal Authority's strict rule requiring relocation every 2 weeks leads to midnight adventures pushing the boat through algae-choked waters, often in the rain, while drunk tourists offer unhelpful navigation advice. After abandoning ship, literally, he leaves a note and the keys in a pub near Camden Lock, he responds to a peculiar housing advertisement that leads him to Morris, a 78-year-old conspiracy theorist whose house listing read like a manifesto. No Remain voters, in capital letters, no practicing religions, though spiritual inquiry acceptable, no musical instruments, due to a traumatic experience with a previous tenant's didgeridoo, and all nationalities welcome exclude Dutch, for reasons Morris refuses to explain but insists far historically justified. Morris's eccentricities provide some of the book's most darkly humorous moments. His semi-detached house in Cricklewood is a shrine to paranoid archiving, walls lined with meticulously preserved newspapers dating back to 1993. Important to have a record, they're rewriting everything these days. He maintains detailed logs of neighborhood cat movements in composition notebooks, convinced they're MI5 surveillance devices. Every Wednesday, he sends 50 checks to Julian Assange in prison, accompanied by cryptic notes written in green ink. His most cherished belief, one he shares with increasing frequency after his evening whiskey, is that George Harrison once slept on his sofa in 1963, despite having bought the house in 1985. When Andy, after several pints at their local pub, asks which Beatle Morris thinks he resembles, Morris's devastating reply of Pete Best, the drummer famously replaced by Ringo Starr, feels like a perfect metaphor for Andy's life, the person left behind when everyone else moved on to better things. These temporary living situations serve as physical manifestations of Andy's internal displacement. Like many newly single people, he's lost not just a relationship, but a home, a routine, and a sense of belonging in the world. The comedy emerges from his increasingly desperate attempts to find solid ground in progressively more absurd circumstances. When Morris wakes him at 3 a.m. to help draft a strongly worded letter to English Heritage regarding their refusal to place a George Harrison commemorative plaque on their house, a disgrace to British culture, Andy reluctantly agrees, finding himself entangled in someone else's delusions while still trying to make sense of his own. These moments of forced participation in others' alternative realities become a strange comfort, providing distraction from the overwhelming task of rebuilding his own life from scratch.
One of the most nuanced aspects of good material is its exploration of how breakups ripple through friendship groups. Andy mourns not just losing Jen, but their foursome friendship. Jen and Jane, Avi and Andy, a perfect synchronization now broken. Initially, his friends rally around him, forming what he calls the Andy Society, a brotherhood dedicated to helping him through his breakup. But as weeks pass, their enthusiasm wanes, and Andy senses their growing impatience with his continued fixation on Jen. This creates a painful imbalance in his friendship with Avi. Andy is falling apart, while Avi seems completely together with his wife, children, and stable home. When Avi offers unwanted advice, telling Andy he's locked in a prison of your own nostalgia and needs to stop thinking about her, Andy feels humiliated by his friend's insights. He resolves to use his Jen tokens more sparingly in conversation, creating a mental system where different types of mentions have different values, from merely saying her name, 2 tokens, to showing people his flat's floor plan, 10 tokens. The book brilliantly captures how men often struggle to support each other through emotional crises. When their friend John experiences his own breakup, the group falls into the same pattern of shallow platitudes and logistics rather than real connection. Andy wants to break this cycle of emotional avoidance, but struggles to find the words. He compares women's emotional fluency to an orchestra, while his contributions feel like hooting along tunelessly like a grade 1 recorder player. This emotional illiteracy isn't presented as an inherent male quality, but rather a learned behavior, one that leaves men ill-equipped to process grief and loss. When Andy's mother tells him, getting dumped is never really about getting dumped, it's about every rejection you've ever experienced, she articulates something Andy has been feeling but couldn't express. Running parallel to Andy's romantic troubles is his professional stagnation. Once a promising comedian who won Best Newcomer at the prestigious Edinburgh Fringe Festival, his career has plateaued, while his friend Emery's star rises dramatically after winning the coveted Golden Mike Award. The contrast between them becomes increasingly painful as their paths diverge. Emery fields calls from Netflix executives about his upcoming special and discusses movie rights with major studios, while Andy's agent Gary hasn't returned his calls in 3 months, not even to discuss local pub gigs. The professional disparity manifests in concrete ways. When Andy discovers he's been downgraded from an E to an F on Comedy Circuit's corporate booking website pricing system, his humiliation is complete. This seemingly arbitrary letter change means his booking fee plummets from $1,000 to $2,000 to a mere $250 to $500 per show. Even worse, he learns about this through an automated email that begins, "Dear valued performer," adding insult to injury. This professional decline culminates in a devastating article titled RIP Stand-Up Comedy, published on influential comedy blog Laugh Track, that systematically eviscerates Andy and his comedy style. The anonymous writer, known only as Comedy Critic, describes him as looking like your worst school geography teacher and a past-it sell-by-date Cornish pasty had a son, and declares his brand of observational comedy not just dated, but actively harmful to the evolution of British comedy. The comments section becomes a feeding frenzy with hundreds of strangers piling on, including someone claiming to have gone to school with Andy at St. Matthew's, calling him a bell end, and recounting an embarrassing incident involving the school nativity play. What hurts most is imagining Jen reading all this, confirming her decision to leave him was right. She always encouraged him to push beyond safe observational humor into more challenging territory. This intersection of professional and personal failure creates a perfect storm of self-doubt that manifests physically. He develops insomnia and starts stress-eating late-night kebabs. If he's not good enough for audiences and not good enough for Jen, who exactly is he? His notebook of comedy ideas, once filled with observations about airline food and dating apps, now reveals nothing with the thematic depth he's seeking to reinvent himself, mirroring his inability to reinvent his personal life. Even his most reliable bits about the peculiarities of British supermarkets feel hollow and meaningless now. The final blow comes when he spots his face on a Where Are They Now listicle of former Best Newcomer winners, alongside a caption reading, "Still performing, mostly corporate events." At 34, he's already being treated as a has-been who never was. Andy's attempt at moving on comes in the form of Sophie, a 25-year-old photographer he meets through his comedian friend Thalia. Their relationship begins with a passionate kiss in a bar bathroom and develops into a series of late-night hookups with one strict rule: no sleepovers. Andy must leave by 2 a.m. Sophie is refreshingly direct, buying rounds equally, discussing her photography career, and showing Andy photos of other men she's dating without jealousy or pretense. Their relationship offers Andy three important revelations: sex doesn't remind him of his ex, he can please someone new, and everything still works. But their connection lacks the emotional depth he had with Jen. When Sophie reluctantly performs Wuthering Heights during a karaoke date with minimal effort, Andy finds himself remembering an early karaoke date with Jen, the passionate singing, the laughter, the intimate connection that lasted until sunrise. The dynamic shifts when Sophie visits Andy's flat for the first time. Rather than their usual hookup, they watch a 3.5-hour Scorsese film, and she becomes unusually curious about his life, examining photos and asking about his absent father. Andy realizes the flip has occurred. She's now more invested than he is, just as he once more invested than Jen. For the first time, he feels sorry for what Jen went through trying to leave him. When Andy eventually breaks things off with Sophie, explaining he can't be in a relationship because he's still recovering from his breakup with Jen, she laughs bitterly, calling him the worst and rejecting his attempt at the "if the timing was different" speech. "What, do you want a round of applause for not ghosting me?" she asks, suggesting he only called because he's friends with her housemate. This painful exchange highlights how our attempts to be good after a breakup often fall short, hurting others in ways we don't fully comprehend. The novel takes a dramatic turn when it shifts to Jen's perspective, revealing her reasons for ending the relationship. Far from the villain Andy has sometimes painted her as, Jen emerges as a complex woman grappling with societal expectations and her own desires. She comes from a family of lifelong monogamists. Both sets of grandparents married 70 years. Her parents met at university. Everyone gets married except her sister Miranda, who ironically married before any of the siblings after coming out as gay. Jen's perception of her parents' successful marriage shattered at 13 when she came home sick to find a woman wearing her mother's dressing gown. Her father claimed the woman was a colleague freshening up and asked Jen not to tell her mother. This incident opened her eyes to how her mother had no career despite her degree, how she raised the children alone while their father worked abroad, and how their shared sense of humor was just her mother laughing at her father's stories. The baby conversation intensified around their 2-year mark. Andy wanted children. Jen wasn't sure. As 35 approached and friends disappeared into parenthood, she waited for maternal desire that never arrived. Andy kept insisting no one is ever ready, which made her resentful since the risk and sacrifice would fall mostly on her. Several events collectively led Jen to end her relationship with Andy. Her grandmother died after telling her she was wise not to have a husband, emphasizing that with her own home, money, education, and career, she had everything. Later, watching a Joni Mitchell documentary, Jen was moved to tears by Mitchell's story of breaking her engagement to Graham Nash because she feared ending up like her frustrated grandmothers who sacrificed their dreams. Andy couldn't understand why this affected her so deeply. The final blow came when her friend Sarah, the only close friend who remained childless like her, announced her pregnancy. Jen felt betrayed and grief-stricken, realizing she was completely alone unless she joined her friends in their family-centered worlds. She began dreaming of a completely different life, away from middle-class London, corporate London, married London. The novel culminates with Andy creating a comedy show about their breakup called Why Elephants Cry, a reference to the book about heartbreak his mother gave him. Initially, Jen refuses permission for him to perform material about their relationship, but their mutual friend Jane convinces her to see the show. Andy performs material about their breakup, his shock, his grief, his desperate attempts to understand what went wrong. He compares his mourning process to elephants scattering bones, examining the skeleton of something that was once so magnificent. After the show, they speak briefly. Jen admits she loved it, despite her reservations, and he asks for her notes. Before parting, Andy acknowledges Jen's need to be alone was genuine, seeing how she'd quit her job to travel solo. They hug goodbye, promising to keep in touch, though knowing they wouldn't. As Jen leaves, she sees Andy surrounded by admirers while she walks home alone, exactly where she needs to be. This ending offers a profound meditation on the nature of closure. There's no dramatic reconciliation or bitter final argument, just two people who once loved each other deeply, now moving in different directions, with a new understanding of why their paths diverged. Andy has transformed his pain into art, finding professional success through his personal tragedy. Jen has embraced her desire for independence, booking a one-way ticket to Cartagena with no fixed destination. Good material reminds us that sometimes the most loving thing we can do is let someone go, not because they're wrong for us, but because we're wrong for them in ways that can't be fixed. As Jen's mother tells her, you don't let go once. You say goodbye over a lifetime. You have to be prepared to let go and let go and let go 1,000 times. In this wisdom lies the true heart of the novel. that love isn't always enough, that understanding sometimes comes too late, and that healing begins not when we find answers, but when we learn to live with the questions.